If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 530, Politicon 2018. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Thursday, October 25th, 2018. Hey, it is almost Halloween. In this episode of the podcast, I'm going to play three interviews that I recorded at Politicon in Los Angeles this past weekend. What I'm about to say will sound like a sponsorship message, but it's really just a simple statement of fact. This episode was made possible by Kevin Lynn and the Center for Progressive Urban Politics. As Sea Realm Vault subscribers surely know, and as many of you probably know, I get paid to write and draw a weekly comic strip about aliens living underground in Antarctica. The comic strip is called GEB, that's G-E-B-B, and the website is gebb.io. And I was included in the Center for Progressive Urban Politics Politicon team, which means I got flown out to Los Angeles, put up in very nice digs. We had some promotional materials made up, including life-size cardboard cutouts of two of the main characters from the comic strip, and a couple thousand postcards printed up. We handed out maybe a few hundred, so there are many left to be distributed. But all of this was possible because I do this comic strip each week for the Center for Progressive Urban Politics, otherwise known as CFPUP. So all of the interviews that you're about to hear are CFPUP YouTube videos. So there is a video component to each of the following interviews. You can find them all on YouTube. I will link to all of the original YouTube videos in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on crealm.com. So the first of the three interviews requires the most setup, I think. You have surely heard reference to Space Force. And if you reflexively ridicule anything Donald Trump says, then you probably reflexively ridiculed the idea of creating a Space Force, and you imagined it to be a group of soldiers in futuristic gear going up into space to do soldiery things, which I suppose is understandable, but also quite silly. As you will hear in the coming interview with Dr. Brian Wheaton, the U.S. military already has a lot of assets in space, and these assets are crucial to ongoing U.S. military missions. Now, if you are a complete pacifist and you wish that the United States did not project military force globally, well, that's a position I can certainly respect. I'm not sure I share it, but I can respect it. But if you condemned the idea of Space Force simply because Donald Trump said it and you think it sounds ridiculous and you investigate it no further, well, that I cannot get behind. If you are listening to this podcast, it is almost assured that you make regular use of something called GPS, or Global Positioning System. And in fact, you've probably asked or heard somebody else ask, how did we ever get along without it? Well, without the U.S. military extending its reach into space, we would not have the GPS system that we do. We rely on space-based assets. And if those assets were to be compromised or destroyed, we would all suffer the consequences. So first, just a little bit more detail on what this whole Space Force thing is supposed to be. So reading now from defensenews.com, this is from a story called Pentagon Presents Recommendations on Space Force to Trump by Valerie Insinna. This was just published yesterday. The National Space Council on Tuesday served up six recommendations to President Donald Trump to enable the creation of a Space Force, moving the birth of a sixth military branch one step closer to fruition. Vice President Mike Pence, who chairs the council, said he anticipated that President Donald Trump will likely take action on at least some of the recommendations very soon. "He only asks me about the Space Force every week," Pence joked. The six recommendations, laid out by Deputy Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan, include language that guides the creation of a unified space command to be known as U.S. Space Command, gives direction on a legislative proposal for a Space Force, calls for creating a funding plan in the fiscal year 2020 budget for a Space Force, outlines an interagency authorities review, establishes Joint Space Development Agency for Technology Procurement, strengthens the relationship between military space and the intelligence community. Now, I started poking around online just to see what non-specialists were saying about the whole Space Force thing. And of course, people for whom their primary political identity and almost their primary identity is their hatred for Donald Trump, of course, had nothing but vacuous ridicule. I found a thread on Reddit where somebody said, you know, we only had one shot at this. We should have called it Starfleet. And then there was a long discussion on that, which was fun but silly. And then I found a more substantial discussion on Reddit. This is on the subreddit Out of the Loop, where one Reddit user wrote, during a rally, Trump announced a new division of the military called Space Force. A lot of people chided him for it, but there is a precedent. The Air Force used to be a division of the Army until it grew in size to warrant being its own thing. Right now, the assets of the U.S. in space, including but not limited to government communications, satellites, the GPS satellites, missile tracking satellites, and other government-owned devices in orbit, are all managed by the Air Force. Given the massive economic and military importance of these assets, it might make sense to create a new branch of the military specifically designated to protect these and other U.S. interests in space. A lot of anti-Trump people are just reflexively mocking the idea as some sort of juvenile fantasy, but the idea has some merit and is based on historical precedent. To which I would add that, you know, many people are mocking it because these were words spoken by Donald Trump, but Donald Trump did not come up with the idea of creating a new branch of government devoted to managing space assets. Space Force is not some random idea pulled from Donald Trump's Twitter feed. Now, before I play the interview with Dr. Brian Wheaton, I want to introduce another concept, and that is the concept of Kessler Syndrome. Those of you who like to read the novels of John Michael Greer might remember his novel Retrotopia, which describes a future nation within the former United States called the Lakeland Republic, which is deliberately and decidedly low-tech. And a visitor from what used to be the East Coast of the United States, which in this future scenario is still quite devoted to high technology, is visiting the Lakeland Republic, and he had just gone to visit one of the Lakeland Republic's most wealthy citizens, a railroad baroness named Janice Mickelson. So John Michael Greer writes, a taxi brought me back to my hotel from Janice Mickelson's mansion. One of her flunkies called it for me, and I spent most of the ride staring out the window and thinking about what she'd said about the pre-war rich. I'd heard plenty of stories along the same lines, of course. Everybody has. But for some reason, my mind kept circling back to the way they dug their own graves and then jumped into them. Why didn't it occur to them that voting themselves $1 billion bonus after another while driving their own employees and the rest of the country into poverty was going to blow up in their faces sooner or later? I was thinking that, staring out at the darkening sky, when a little pale streak brought me back to reality. The dozens of governments and corporations that kept launching satellites even after 2029, when the Kessler Syndrome in low Earth orbit should have given them a wake-up call, had gone waltzing just as cluelessly into a preventable disaster of their own. I thought of the mess we'd gotten into back home by going long on nuclear power plants in the 2040s, long after it should have been clear to everyone that nuclear power was, what was Fred Vanich's phrase, a subsidy dumpster? One more technological white elephant that never paid for itself and only looked profitable because most of the costs were shoved out of sight one way or another. I thought of the war going on 1,000 miles south of me just then and wondered sourly why a species that was so smart at coming up with clever technologies was so dumb about so much else. So John Michael Greer just mentions in passing there the Kessler Syndrome, which took place in low Earth orbit sometime around 2029. In this point of the narrative, he doesn't say any more about what that means. But my next guest, Dr. Brian Wheaton, will, near the beginning of our conversation.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
I'm KMO. I'm here at Politicon 2018, and I am with Dr. Brian Wheaton, whose credentials I cannot rattle off from memory. So I'm going to look at my notes, and I'm going to say that he's the Director of Planning for the Secure World Foundation, where he specializes in space debris, global space situational awareness, space traffic management, protection of space assets, and space governance. Any one of those would be a fascinating, long conversation, and we won't get to all of them, I'm afraid. Although I think space debris is in the news, although a lot of people might not realize that it's in the news because it's been eclipsed by this very colorful concept of Space Force.
Yes.
How does Space Force relate to space debris? Maybe say just a little primer on what space debris is and why it's important.
Sure. So we've been launching stuff into space since Sputnik in 1957. And a lot of that stuff is still up there. At the moment, there are something on the order of 1,800 active functioning satellites in orbit around the Earth, along with something on the order of 23,000 pieces of debris bigger than a softball. The leftovers of all the stuff we put up there in the past.
So, again, 23,000 pieces.
And that's
a,
that's
a lot to keep track of.
And that's just the stuff bigger than a softball.
Yeah.
If you go down to, you know, a centimeter or so, we're talking probably 500,000 pieces.
And these things are moving at a great rate of speed.
Yeah. You know, the speed depends upon the altitude because they have to basically move forward to stay in orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking at 400 kilometers where the space station is, they're moving about 7 kilometers a second, which is something on the order of 22,000, 20,000 miles per hour. A little bit slower speed higher up, but yeah, they're moving pretty fast. So if they collide with something, you get a big boom and lots of additional space debris that then keeps flying around.
And there's the possibility that with enough stuff up there, colliding, breaking up, creating more stuff up there, you get something called Kessler syndrome.
Yeah, so Don Kessler was a NASA scientist working on this issue back in the 1970s. And it's interesting, what he wrote about was that at some point we might have enough junk up there so that the collisions between the junk generates more new debris than what gets cleaned out by the atmosphere, and the population goes up. And that's actually happening. Keep in mind, though, that this is more like climate change than it is a nuclear reaction, right? It's a slow process that takes place over decades, if not longer, that's gradually increasing the risk to orbiting in certain parts of space. And that's a problem, but it's not like we're going to lose it all tomorrow if something bad happens. Definitely something we need to think about because we got to worry about things like protecting the astronauts and keeping satellites from getting hit because we use those for a lot of really interesting stuff here on Earth.
Say more about that. I mean, I think a lot of people probably don't realize quite how much their lives depend on functioning satellites.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, you know, sort of that invisible infrastructure, right, that supports a lot of what we do. So a couple of good examples. If you're watching a live sporting event from somewhere in the world, let's say the Olympics or the Super Bowl or the World Cup or something, odds are that television signal is being routed over satellites. So that's how we're going to get it broadcast around the world. If you wake up in the morning and check the weather, there's a really good probability that a big chunk of the weather forecast, the data that goes into that, is coming from satellites that are orbiting the Earth and monitoring what's going on. And when you pull out your phone and pull up Google Maps to go to navigate to somewhere, the signal that tells you where you are so you can navigate, GPS, is coming from a bunch of satellites.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole variety of ways that we use satellites every day, and you know it's not over exaggerating to say that our economy and global society basically runs on space and satellites. So it's just that they're invisible; we don't really see them a whole lot. So that's the biggest reason why I have to worry about space sustainability is we don't want to lose all those benefits.
Now, GPS, global positioning system, is something that it does more than just tell us where we are when we're using Google Maps. All manner of location-based services are dependent upon that. And it was initially a military project.
It still is a military project.
But it certainly has a wide variety of civilian applications now.
Absolutely. So it was started, the military basically needed a way to do two things. They needed to be able to synchronize time globally, and they needed to be able to have a good position fix so they can navigate and they can also guide aircraft and ships and planes and all kinds of stuff. And so that led to GPS. But not long after it was created, there was a realization there was also, as you point out, a whole bunch of civil benefits we could get from it. And so the U.S. government made a decision in the mid-1990s to make it officially a dual-use program where the Department of Transportation and the Department of Defense both have a say in running it, and we end up using it for a whole bunch of civil applications. And, of course, what's happened since then is, you know, the number of non-military users using it has dwarfed the military users, even though it's still a very important system for the military.
Well, I'm bringing up military issues because obviously we're working around to Space Force at some point or another. But first, talk about the relationship or the dependence, you might say, of drones as the military uses them on satellites.
So over the last, say, 15, 20 years, the U.S. military has put a lot of effort into integrating space capabilities into the way it fights wars and the way it projects power on Earth. So that includes everything from satellites that collect imagery and intelligence and do reconnaissance, to GPS, to satellite communications, and all of that is sort of exemplified in the case of UAVs, or as the public version as drones, which have been a big part of how the military has been fighting the war on terror the last 15 years or so. You know, a lot of those UAVs are orbiting Afghanistan, Iraq, other places in the world, but they are being flown from the United States. There are pilots sitting in, you know, rooms in Las Vegas and elsewhere, mm-hmm. and the command signals are being routed over satellites. And those UAVs, mostly what they do is they watch at stuff, right? They have cameras on board, and they're taking imagery or they're running video feeds over very long, multiple hours worth of time. And those video feeds are getting routed around the world to different military installations using satellites. And there are some of them that are equipped with missiles that are used offensively to go try and attack things. And when they fire those missiles are being guided using GPS. And then when it's all over, they use other methods, either UAVs or satellites, to fly over and see did they actually hit what they were supposed to get at. So UAVs are a very interesting example of how space is being used by the military every day to do stuff. And if you think of any other mission the military does, odds are there's a space component to it.
So, as you say, the U.S. military is heavily involved in space in a variety of ways right now. What the president has proposed has this provocative name, Space Force, and it conjures up images of, you know, maybe dressing soldiers up like Buck Rogers and sending them off into space to do, you know, play war games or something. But really what he's talking about is an administrative reorganization of all of the things that are already going on.
That's exactly right. This is a debate that's been going on for just about 20 years now. How should we organize our national security space activities? And by that, I mean the military space and then the intelligence space. Right now, the Air Force runs a big chunk of the military space. There's an organization called the National Reconnaissance Office that runs a big chunk of the intelligence space. That's generally what happens, or how it works right now. But there's been challenges that have erupted, you know, problems with that existing framework that has led people to wonder, should we do something new? And the Space Force is one specific answer to that, which says we should take all that stuff and move it into a totally separate branch of the military called the Department of the Space Force that would then go and just focus just on space. And that's what the president has directed the military to go do.
What are the supposed advantages of that reorganization?
Well, it's probably best to look at that from the criticisms of the current setup. One of the biggest criticisms is that a lot of it right now is being run by the U.S. Air Force, and their priority, not surprisingly, is Air Force and air power. So, for example, when the budget cuts hit after the 2013 Budget Control Act, probably known as sequestration, it turns out the Air Force ended up applying those cuts more to space than to some of the aircraft programs. Right? They basically prioritized the aircraft over space. And then when there was some budget relief, again, a lot of the relief money went to beefing up air programs and not space programs. There's another challenge, which is that the way satellites operate in space, we know if it was orbital mechanics, is very different from the way airplanes fly and from what most of us think about how physics works. For example, if there's an astronaut on the space station that throw a tennis ball, it's about 90 minutes later, the tennis ball is going to come back to about the same spot where he threw it from, because it's in orbit right alongside of it. It doesn't fly off into some other place. It doesn't deorbit. It just keeps going around, because that's orbital mechanics. So there's something else to be said, that if you have an organization primarily made of pilots and Air Force guys and women, they don't really understand space at the fundamental level. And so they might not always be doing the best things for space. So those are a couple of the challenges with the current setup. And so the thinking is that if you create a new organization, then it'll be able to focus on space. It'll be able to do some of the new things that military thinks need to be done to deal with some of the new threats. that'll be able to recruit and train people to focus space and be real space experts, and not just space, not just Air Force people that dabble in space occasionally. That's the thinking behind it.
Can you take the other side and criticize the proposal?
Oh, absolutely. Because I'm actually very much a critic of it.
Well, then you've done an excellent job of laying out the points of the other side. Yep. You've done an admirable job at not being a polemicist.
Thank you. The biggest problem with this is that it is an absolutely massive change from a bureaucratic institutional perspective. You're talking about, you know, moving around tens of thousands of people from the Air Force, but also from the Army and the Navy and the NRO and other places, and mashing them all together and changing things up and creating new organizations and new command structures. And there are millions of associated details with that. You know, what's the uniform going to look like? What are they going to call the rank structures? That are, in my mind, going to be a huge distraction from actually fixing the problem, right? So one would think that if the problem is we need to fix how we buy satellites and we need to fix our training, our knowledge, why don't we just do that instead of spending 5-10 years or more changing the organization in the hope that at the end of that we can actually address some of these problems. To me, that's the biggest argument against this, is that it is hugely complicated, and there are the track record of the government getting big reorganizations right is not good.
So what's a more promising way of addressing the sort of myopia of the Air Force when it comes to space?
Well, that's the real challenge here, right? One of the alternatives is something called a Space Corps, which would look a lot like the Marine Corps. So the Marines are a separate entity that exists within the Department of the Navy. They have their own culture, they have their own uniforms, they have their own commandant, but they rely on the Navy for a lot of the overhead functions. And that makes it a little bit leaner and a little bit more agile and flexible, able to do stuff. And so one of the alternatives is to create a Space Corps within the Air Force that would have a walled-off budget, be able to get its own culture, but you wouldn't have to deal with things like, you know, how they're going to have, who's going to do their medical services, you know, what bases are they going to be located on, all this kind of, again, overhead stuff. The problem is that the Air Force really hasn't shown themselves to be a good steward. Even after President Trump made the directive to go create a Space Force, the Air Force has done a lot of things to try and slow roll this, or to try and, you know, introduce a poison pill to try and kill it off, and just haven't demonstrated that they're recognizing that they need to change. So unfortunately, it looks like there's not really going to be a choice other than to do something separate, even though that's probably going to mean several years of confusion and, you know, lots of stuff probably getting screwed up before we actually get to the right answer.
You know, when we talk about space, particularly with a military perspective in mind, it seems kind of strange to even call it space, because when I think of space, I think of the, you know, billions and billions of light years of vacuum in all directions. But really what we're interested in is the place where the atmosphere, or where the sky goes from being blue to being black, just this very, very nearby location.
Right. And as I mentioned, you know, the U.S. has come a long ways in integrating space into all of the stuff it does here on Earth, right? So for the U.S., it's about how does it protect those space capabilities so that it can use space for its military. And we're not the only ones. Russia, China, Europe, India, many other countries are on the same path, and they're all developing their own military space capabilities. So the problem is, you know, future wars, particularly against a near-peer adversary, right, a Russia or a China, are probably going to involve space on both sides to some extent, which means both sides are probably going to be interested in trying to take out the other guy's space stuff and protect their own. And that is one of the big things that's driving this. You know, for the last 17 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've been fighting against adversaries that really haven't had a lot of capability to reach out and touch our satellites or do a whole lot about it. I mean, there's some things they've done, but nothing like an organized state would have. So that's really underlying a big part of this, is as the military shifts towards thinking about future conflicts, which, you know, they've said they've decided is more likely going to involve a near-peer adversary like Russia or China, then that's probably going to involve space to as part of the conflict. And so how are we going to deal with that? And you know, there's a lot of drive to try and get the reorganization piece done so we can prepare for that.
I think people are familiar with the concept of cyber warfare. And cyber warfare takes place between, as you would say, the near peers of the United States, particularly, you know, in people's minds right now, Russia. But at the same time, the same entities with whom we are having these contests in cyberspace, you know, they are our trading partners. They are organizations with whom we have to coordinate in order to keep the business of daily life in 21st century Earth going on. So there has to be, and there clearly is, a possibility for competition tempered with cooperation. Mm-hmm. What do we have to look forward to in terms of a cooperative sphere above the Earth?
Well, and you know, a lot of those same dynamics there in space. At the moment, you know, we are partners with Russia in the International Space Station.
In fact, we can't send astronauts to space without Russia's help.
That is absolutely correct. Just recently, in the last week or so, there was another launch from on the Russian Soyuz, included a U.S. astronaut. They had a launch abort problem, and thankfully got out okay. But you know, ever since we ended the shuttle program, we've been relying on Russia to get our astronauts up to the space station. So you know, absolutely, we are collaborating with them on that. When it comes to China, it's a little bit harder. There was a law passed in the U.S. several years ago that prohibits NASA or a couple other agencies from doing bilateral cooperation with China in space without getting permission from Congress first, which has been very much the turn to kind of doing that. But we've talked about, you know, there's we're doing some scientific research with them, some type of cooperation. And there's a whole discussion going on right now about what is the future of human exploration going to be. There's a lot of talk of going back to the moon with NASA building what they call the Lunar Gateway and potentially going back to the surface of the moon.
China has sent a probe to the surface of the moon.
China has sent a probe. They've got a whole series of probes going there. There's a huge discussion right now about what is the next thing. It's probably going to be something involving the moon. And there's a sense from the U.S., from the Trump administration, we have to do this internationally. We can't afford to do it by ourselves. So that's an open question as to what the international cooperation looks like going forward on space and whether or not it's going to include Russia and China in addition to Europe and Japan and Canada and many others. It absolutely is a realm where we're both cooperating and competing. And the other big thing is the commercial sector.
Yep.
Over the last 15 years, commercial space has exploded in a good way. You know, we're seeing not only the SpaceX's and the launching companies, mm-hmm. but companies like Planet Labs that is now is almost 200 satellites the size of a toaster that are imaging the entire Earth once a day. And that is providing a huge amount of data to support sustainable development, support agriculture and how we use resources. And there's, you know, billions of dollars in private capital flowing into space, tons of new investment. That is all going to yield a whole bunch of new ideas and innovations, how we use space, more benefits. So you have this military competition, you have the exploration of the science, and you have the commercial all going at the same time. And how they interact, it's complicated, and that's a huge part of what we need to think about with the whole Space Force, is how do we keep that and a potential conflict from disrupting or destroying some of the other benefits we get.
So is keeping all of those factors in mind and thinking clearly about it what is meant by global space situational awareness?
So space situation awareness is a fancy term for figuring out what's going on in space and, you know, where's it all going. So keeping track of all the space debris, all the functional satellites, you know, when they maneuver, when they change their orbits, are they going to collide or not? Space weather, because yes, there is weather in space, mm-hmm. and how that impacts us. All of that is wrapped under space situation awareness. So for the military's perspective, SSA is a big part of how do we figure out what the threats are coming to a satellite and how to protect the satellite. For NASA, SSA is all about how do we protect the ISS and the astronauts from getting hit by a piece of debris. And for everybody, it's things like space weather and other things that kind of impact everyone. At the moment and historically, the biggest supplier of SSA data has been the U.S. military. But like in other places, there's a lot of commercial investment in that now. And so there's a big debate underway. Should we move part of that away from the military to a civil agency, sort of like we have the FAA that does air traffic management? Should we have a civil agency that's got a version of air traffic control radars that are doing space traffic management? And what is the role for academia or industry to provide commercial data to support that? That's a big debate, been away for several years. The Trump administration has actually published a policy back in June that gives the Department of Commerce authorities in this, and they started to move in that direction. But we're still waiting for Congress, who obviously has the final say on the budget, all that stuff, to whether or not they're going to approve that.
Well, that is a lot to keep in mind, and it is, in all honesty, it is a deeper coverage of the topic than I think most people will be interested in. So let's pull back a little bit and dial down the complexity a little bit. What are the main points that somebody who is not thinking about these topics on a day-to-day basis, but they, you know, their attention has been caught by Trump Space Force? What should they understand, which the mainstream media is not really providing for them?
So the big issues are that we have already had a lot of military space activities. Those have been going on for a long time. And the question is how best to organize those and how to do so in a way that doesn't jeopardize the scientific exploration, the human exploration, and the commercial developments in space. That's really the biggest issue to focus on.
And just on a non-space note, you're here at Politicon. Do you have any thoughts on just the political divisions or the representations of those divisions in our culture right now?
Well, you know, one advantage of being a space guy is space is usually not a partisan issue, right? Usually NASA has pretty good support. Usually the space stuff that happens to the military is usually not all that controversial. And usually we also kind of exist off in the corner and nobody pays attention to us, right, in terms of the bigger discussion. And then Trump goes off and talks to the Space Force, and suddenly everybody cares about space. And everybody has an opinion on the Space Force. And, you know, on one hand, that has, I think that's good in that it's exposing these issues to more people than I think we normally get to them. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people that are either for the Space Force because they love Trump, or they're against it because they hate him.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that has added this polarizing element to the debate. And I don't know yet whether his involvement's been a good thing or not.
It's certainly got people talking about an issue that an issue that's very important,
right,
which is often ignored.
Right. And you know, this age-old debate, you know, is all publicity good,
right?
I don't know. Maybe. It might turn out okay. Only time will tell,
I think. Did he spell space correctly in his tweet?
Well, it'd be hard not to spell it correctly or incorrectly, I think.
Well, Dr. Brian Wheaton, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
That was Dr. Brian Wheaton. And I hope that conversation gave you a bit more context when thinking about the concept of a so-called space force and the alternative option of creating a space corps, which would be to the Air Force what the Marine Corps is to the Navy. There is quite a lot going on in space right now, or at least in low Earth orbit, and that level of activity will increase in the foreseeable future. Some governing bodies, some system of governance and oversight will be required. Does it have to be military? No. Our air traffic control systems, while they have to coordinate with the military, are not themselves military bodies, and I think we could implement something similar with regard to space. All right, switching from space and technology to the more general topic of science and science awareness, walking around at Politicon, handing out postcards for the comic strip, I met some folks who were at a booth called Science Debate. One of the three people that I talked to at that booth was Cheryl Kirschenbaum. She's the executive director of Science Debate, and she is also the host of Serving Up Science, an NPR podcast. So here is my conversation with Cheryl Kirschenbaum. We are at Politicon 2018. I'm KMO, and I am here with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, who is a podcaster herself and an NPR host of a show called Serving Up Science. But here at Politicon, what are you doing?
So I am here with Science Debate. We're a C3 nonpartisan, and we simply ask candidates running for office to talk about science policy before Election Day. So the whole idea is that democracy works when people are well-informed, and we think we're all going to be a little more well-informed when we start hearing about issues like climate change, energy, food security, mental health, opioids, before Election Day, as the expectation for every citizen, not the exception when we get real lucky that someone's willing to talk about them.
We have a lot of lawyers in Congress and in the Senate, not so many scientists. How do you talk to lawyers about science?
Well, look, I think most of us think back to our time in high school when, to be fair, a lot of people don't like science all that much. They get stuck in really long, boring lab periods.
Yeah.
But it's really about humanizing science stories, right? We all care for our loved ones who have cancer, who have Alzheimer's. We hopefully vaccinate our kids to protect them from the flu or polio or the measles. I think science policies should really help to make sure we have enough food to feed 9 billion people by 2050. They should make sure every citizen has access to clean and safe drinking water. And I live in Michigan now, where so many people don't.
That is an issue.
Dictate the way that we support and treat veterans when they return home from serving our country. They should help protect vulnerable populations in parts of the world that are at risk of going underwater, like Miami and New Orleans. There are so many issues that I think, you know, we don't expect candidates to remember the fifth number in pi. We certainly don't need them to tell us anything.
I can't tell you what it is.
Right. But I do think they should be prepared to know what their policies would look like, since science is inherently related to every significant challenge we face.
What's the short list of things that lawmakers should know about science that, unfortunately, they are currently lacking?
Well, I think it's not necessarily about that. I think it's putting people in positions of influence in their offices. So I used to be a Senate staffer. I worked for Senator Bill Nelson from Florida. He's still there. State of Florida, moderate Democrat. I think a great person, the kind of person that I would like to see more of in office. I worked with some of the smartest people I've ever had the pleasure of working with when I was there. I left in 2006, so I think politics has changed quite a bit since then. But what I noticed early on was there were very few scientists in those staff positions at all, there to translate kind of the cutting-edge complex research into a relatable policy language for candidates. So I think there's a lot of talk now about, like, we know about the 314 PAC, Political Action Committee, getting scientists to run for Congress. I think there's a place for that, but I also think at a time when there are fewer and fewer tenure-track jobs available for people who are training to be scientists, we should really be showing what these viable, impactful careers in policy can look like, and maybe push some of them into those staff positions that are going to influence the people making decisions about our health and safety and security and standing as a global leader.
It occurs to me, and I don't have your experience, you know, being there in Washington, but that congressional staffers must be getting a lot of scientific information, and you can put that in scare quotes if you want to, from lobbyists. Is that the case?
So I'll say this, and again, this was 12 years ago that I was there. But what I found I was working as a legislative assistant, so working as the person hearing about the science from groups that would come in. I might have five different groups come on a single day to talk to me about a science issue coming up in legislation. Very few of them were actual scientists working at universities, but they were often people with very fancy degrees, maybe in economics, but not climate economists, just people with degrees that gave them a doctor in front of their name. They were usually very articulate, very funny. At the time, they could leave us little gifts or things like that. I don't think that's still the case. And when scientists did make their way into my office, they didn't usually have a clear message. They didn't know what the take-home should be. They often talked about p-values or significance values in data, and sometimes they'd print PowerPoint slides. And so it's no wonder they had challenges connecting with staffers, because at the end of the day, staffers are bright. They need to tell their boss three things. They need to tell their boss, what's the issue? Why does it matter? How does it affect our constituents, our state? And it wasn't the scientists that were making that case well. They don't have the power. They don't have the platform. And frankly, they don't have many of them don't have the communication skills to do that. But I feel like the climate of that is changing. I think more and more people going into the sciences see the interdisciplinary nature of how their work has impact beyond the lab, and so I've personally been involved in a lot of university training programs for scientists to incorporate communications into their degree, or policy, or journalism, and find new ways to tell their stories.
Do you think it's a matter strictly of training in communication, or is there a temperament aspect to scientists and communicating with non-scientists?
I think there's a lot of pieces to it, right? So I think we in the science community need to be more comfortable telling our stories, because when we don't do that, other people often do it for us and we don't like the result.
Right.
I think that there's a lot that the media and journalists can learn about how to ask questions, what's most important, why we don't have to have this sense of two sides when it comes to a lot of these science issues. So everything looks like there's a balanced 50-50 argument either way on issues like climate change. I also think we have to do more to get people with that kind of expertise in positions of influence. And again, not just as policymakers, but people working with those policymakers.
So climate change is an obvious place where scientific literacy and approaches to science are very relevant to politics. But I think it's also a place where so much well poisoning has already taken place that a lot of people are not open to talking about it. You're at least not open to examining the views of somebody they consider to be a political opponent. But are there other issues of science or scientific areas of policy importance that are not so charged, where there is the possibility of maybe doing some bridge building between factions?
I hope so. I mean, I think both, I mean, we often talk about Republicans having this war against science, or at least that's something I hear and see in book titles and things quite a bit. But I think both Republicans and Democrats have politicized science to suit a particular agenda. And because of that, while these issues impact every one of us, we kind of look at them as needing to feel tied to one opinion or the other based on our party affiliation. But like when we talk about caring for our loved ones with cancer, when we talk about the opioid epidemic, when we talk about preparing to combat the next superbug because of our overuse of antibiotics, these are very human stories. And, you know, ultimately, I think for the most part, 99.9% of us want to make the right choice to protect our family, our community, our friends, our loved ones. And we're coming from that place. But maybe we have to change the way that we talk about a lot of these issues to get there.
I agree. Well, Cheryl Kirshenbaum, let me leave you with the opportunity to promote any organizations that you are here to represent.
Sure. Well, I'd encourage everyone to go to sciencedebate.org. You can click on this interactive map we have and see if the candidates running in your state before the midterms have responded to 10 questions from us and what their positions are before you vote. So about, Thomas Jefferson said that whenever the people are well-informed, they can be trusted with their own government. I think that's how democracy works. So our idea is just to help us all be a little more informed. We are going to be very active toward the 2020 election, so watch for live science forums, hopefully in the Midwest next summer. We want to do some live events and get candidates really talking about these issues so we all know where they stand before we vote.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
That was Cheryl Kirshenbaum, and if you liked what she had to say, she does have her own podcast produced at NPR station WKAR. It's called Serving Up Science. She also has a website, which is just her name, CherylKirshenbaum.com. Although Cheryl is spelled S-H-E-R-I-L. Again, all of the interviews that you're hearing in this episode of the Sea Realm podcast are taken from YouTube videos at the Center for Progressive Urban Politics YouTube channel. That's CFPUP or CFPUP. So I recorded several other interviews at Politicon 2018, but the last one that I'm going to play for you in this episode is a lighter one, and for me, it was a lot of fun. This is by Goat vs. Fish, whom I would describe as a performance artist. He's clearly in character, and he stayed in character all day for the two consecutive days of Politicon. At the end of the first day, many, many hours after he and I recorded the conversation you're about to hear, I was hauling our gear from the booth out to our car. The show was over, people were being ushered out, and Goat vs. Fish was still in character, still talking in his very distinctive way to a convention goer near the exit doors.
This is KMO. We are at Politicon, and I'm speaking with Goat vs. Fish.
Goat vs. Fish. Yes, I am Goat vs. Fish. I'm Goat vs. Fish.
Tell me more about your name, Goat vs. Fish.
Ah, well, Goat vs. Fish is the forever versus of all goat and all fish. Look about you, and you will see all the goat and fish. Yes, some have not yet chosen goat or fish, but it is all goat versus fish. I am the unity and disunity of goat and fish, and I am Goat vs. Fish.
Is there no possibility for goat fish?
Ah, the unity of goatfish. Do you seek the unity of goat and fish?
I inquire as to the possibility.
The unity of goatfish can be achieved by a goat and fish, but only if they both dispense with the verses and choose to form the unity of the goatfish. Just as this politicon, there was a goat and a fish that did form the unity of the goatfish. It was very splendid verses. But if even one goat or fish does not wish to form the unity of the goatfish, then it is a versus. It is goat versus fish.
Do you think that we are predisposed to choose versus?
Well, it is goat versus fish. It is all goat versus fish. Now, if one is predisposed to choose goat or fish, well, goat versus fish is trying to find this as well. Very curious about all the ones such as you, if they are goat, if they are fish. But goat versus fish does not know. That is why goat versus fish asks, are you goat or are you fish? Are you goat or fish?
I'm not sure how I would determine that.
It comes from within you. It is not for goat versus fish to say, yes. Some look at the verses of evidence. They say, oh, I enjoy frolicking on the land or swimming in the sea, and they choose goat or fish for these verses. Others, they simply know it deep within their very verses if they are goat or fish. But these are your verses. Yes, continue. What do you have to say to goat versus fish?
I am a terrestrial being. I walk upon the ground. But I know that in my evolutionary past, there is also aquatic ancestry.
Interesting verses.
Yeah, so I remember scuba diving and feeling very vulnerable and out of sorts because I couldn't see what was behind me and I couldn't easily turn to see what was behind me.
Can you usually see what is behind you?
Well, I can easily turn.
Yes.
And see what is behind me when I'm planted on dry ground. But in the water, it's not so easy and I feel uncomfortable.
It could be a versus of goat. It could be goat for you, yes. The goat do go to the sea to versus the fish. If this is so, that is pleasant that you go to see the fish. But perhaps you are a fish that has been trapped on the land of the goat seeking to be among the fish, which is why you went to the fish. It could be those verses.
How would I know?
It is for you to say. It is only for you to say. You will know when you are a goat, when you say that you are a goat, and then you become a goat. Or a fish. Now, you said that in previous verses, in verses long past, perhaps you were a fish. Perhaps you were a fish. Perhaps you were a fish, and then you became a goat. Or perhaps you were a goat, and then you became a fish. You can be goat, and then you can choose fish, but you cannot be goat and fish in the same verses. Yes, in this verse, you choose goat or fish.
But the verses is not a given. There is the possibility of the unity.
I am goat versus fish, the goatfish, the unity and disunity of goat and fish. It is always goat versus fish, the goatfish.
I see.
Yes, you are beginning to learn the verses.
Maybe I'm speaking words that indicate that I'm beginning to understand, but I'm not.
Ah.
I'm not.
That is pitiable to goat versus fish. Goat versus fish suspects that you do not understand goat versus fish because you have not yet chosen goat or fish. But at this verses, many are speaking of voting, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Now, goat versus fish, yes, do you vote goat, do you vote fish? But what is it these other verses that the ones are speaking of? Some have spoken of a republic. What are these goat and fish that the ones also speaking of to goat versus fish?
Typically, we're called upon to choose Democrat or Republican.
And this is goat versus fish?
Could be fish versus goat. I'm not sure. I don't know how they map.
I heard one that said a Democrat was a goat. Goat versus fish is not here to say it, but one that was a goat said Democrat was a goat. So that is one evidence for goat. We shall see. It is a long versus ahead.
Yes, I tend to vote libertarian.
Ah, what sort of verses are these? Tell us of the libertarian if it is a goat or a fish.
Well, libertarians come in a variety of flavors, but an easy way to say it is that they tend to agree with conservatives and Republicans on financial matters and economic matters, and they tend to agree with Democrats and liberals on social matters. So libertarians believe that the drug war should be ended. But they also believe that the welfare state should be ended.
What should be continuing?
What should be continuing is individual...
Other than goat versus fish. Of course, we always continue goat versus fish.
Individual initiative, entrepreneurial initiative. I think many libertarians, not me, but many libertarians place a very high value on contracts. So agreements that people enter into voluntarily, they hold those as being almost sacred. Again, that's not my particular brand of libertarianism, but it needs to be included when describing what libertarians are.
Yes, that is, you are speaking of goatfish, yes, when the goat and the fish, yes, they must both agree to form the unity of the goatfish. They must agree to do it. They must agree to do it.
It seems they don't very often agree.
They do seek verses. It is the way of the goat to verses the fish. It is the way of the fish to verses the goat. Now, goat versus fish is always pleasant to see a goat versusing a fish because it is goat versus fish. But I am goat versus fish, the goatfish, and sometimes the goatfish does like to see the unity of goat and fish, yes?
There is no indication of unity on your headgear, though, but there is the verses.
There is the verses, yes. There is the verses, yes. There is always goat versus fish. And as far as the ones, you say you celebrate the ones that are out there spreading their own verses, yes, bringing their verses to all the ones, yes. That is what goat versus fish is doing. I am being goat versus fish. I am here to spread the verses of goat versus fish. It is at goat vs. fish on all social media. The Instagram, the Book of Faces, the Twitterver, yes. And the Goat versus Fish podcast. Yes, you can even hear the Goat versus Fish podcast. It is recorded at the Comedy Store Los Angeles. It is the place of Goat versus Fish. You should follow Goat versus Fish.
Follow Goat versus Fish.
Thank you, yes. Ah, that is the most Goat versus Fish verses that you have had. There's all verses. But are you goat or are you fish? Final verses.
I cannot commit.
Ah, it is a fence sitter. Ooh, it is a fence sitter. Well, goat versus fish knows just what to do. Knows just what to do with this one. Just one versus, just one versus. Fence sitter's always being so bothersome to goat. I don't know if I should choose goat or fish. I do not know if I'm a goat. Ah, yes. For the fence sitter that will choose neither goat nor fish, it is the fence for you. And to remind you of the unpleasantness of the fence... Oh, you have not yet chosen goat or fish. You have not yet chosen goat or fish. That is for you, fence sitter. You sit upon the fence.
Thank you.
Always thank goat versus fish. Always thank goat versus fish.
All right. So, from the fence at Politicon 2018, I'm KMO, and this has been Goat versus Fish.
It has been Goat versus Fish, and it will still continue to be Goat versus Fish even after these verses. Ah, would you like to be on the Goat versus Fish Instagram?
Please.
Yes, we can spread the verses of this one, yes? Goat versus fish, yes, you can show them that you are a fence sitter, yes? And if you wish to make the sign of the fence sitter, it is as this. It is always going up one way and then another way, and yes, goat versus fish can... Yes, 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 that is so. Goat versus fish. Goat versus fish. Yes, what do you say to these verses? Is this pleasant to you?
This works.
That was Goat versus Fish. Goat versus Fish has his own YouTube channel and his own podcast. Any search engine or Twitter will take you to his material straight away. Again, that's Goat versus Fish. And I am now the proud owner of a Goat versus Fish fence sitter card. I'm a fence sitter for my libertarian leanings. As I've mentioned before, I describe myself as a recovering libertarian, which is to say I'm not ideologically hidebound. And I don't believe that there is any one political philosophy which, if implemented truly and without half measures or reservations, would create a paradise on Earth, regardless of the starting conditions. I think that different situations call for different policy responses, and that the form one's government takes is not the primary determining factor in how happy the people living in that country are, or how well their society works. It's certainly a significant factor, but I don't believe there is one and only one form of governance that works best in all situations. That said, I am committed to protecting the rights of the individual and always erring on the side of individual autonomy in questions of should we favor the individual or should we favor the group. There will be a follow-up episode to this episode of the C-Rom podcast where I will play the conversations that I recorded at Politicon, which are more straightforwardly political than the ones you heard in this episode. Also, I'd like to mention that, you know, I have a Patreon page. It's Patreon/KMO, just the three letters, KMO. And on that page, most of what I post there is behind the paywall, but I did post two fairly lengthy essays about my experiences at Politicon, and those are both unlocked. Anybody can read them. So if you just go to Patreon and you search for KMO, or you just type in patreon.com/KMO, you can find my two blog posts, My Politicon Experience Part 1 and Part 2. And I've started a third part, although I don't think it will be up until tomorrow at the earliest. It's about time for me to shift gears and get into comic strip creation mode. There will be a new installment of the comic strip at geb.io this coming Sunday. I hope that you will check it out. More people listen to the podcast than read the comic strip, and the comic strip doesn't take nearly as much of your time as the podcast does. So I hope that you will check it out. And also, I should mention that I have been kicked off of Facebook. I will not be creating a new account to get back in there. I'm just done with Facebook. Which means, unfortunately, I am no longer a participant in the Friends of the CROM group on Facebook, but there is a CROM podcast discussion group on MeWe.com. And a good handful of the heavy hitters from the Friends of the CROM have made the move over to MeWe. So you can find some good discussions there on the sorts of topics that I cover here on the CROM podcast. I hope you'll check it out. Also, I am tweeting a whole lot more than I used to before I got kicked off of Facebook. So my Twitter handle is KMO spelled out phonetically. It's KAYEMMO. I tweeted out a lot of the photos that I took at Politicon. So if you'd like to see some images of what I experienced there, just find me on Twitter. As I say, I have more Politicon material to share, and so you'll be hearing from me again quite soon. I hope that you'll join me for the next episode of the CROM podcast, and until that time, I hope that you will stay well.